Welcome. I'm Catherine Austin Fitz, president of Solari. This is the first chapter of our audio seminar, Positioning Your Assets for Growth in Uncertain Times. At Solari, we publish audio seminars to respond to your most frequently asked questions. This audio seminar is of particular importance because it is responding to questions essential to your financial security. More and more people realize things are not as they seem. When this happens, one of their first questions is, what does this mean to how I manage my retirement savings? Then, over a series of days and weeks and months, there follow a stream of questions as they leave their current paradigm and begin to shift their lives and assets into a new paradigm. This audio seminar is designed to help you journey through this transition. By sharing our approach and what we've learned, we hope to help you gather power and create pathways that work for you. You'll find an outline for this seminar as well as other recommended reading material on the audio seminar resource page. This includes before and after sample investment portfolios and several charts. If you can, follow along with us on the resource page, or pause here and print out copies of the materials and use those to follow along with us. I also want to emphasize that nothing in this Solari audio seminar should be taken as individual investment advice. Each person, each place, each family, each situation is unique. Anyone seeking investment advice for his or her personal financial situation is encouraged to seek out a qualified advisor. Chapter 2, The Fundamental Shift Underway. We are experiencing a period of rapid change, one that can have significant consequences for our personal assets and financial security. It is invaluable to invest time to understand what is happening. What's going on in our environment? What does it mean to us? What does it mean to those we love? My goal for this audio seminar is we help you see and understand what is happening so that you can see the opportunities and risks that will help you develop a practical action plan for you. First, America's command of global resources has been declining steadily for quite some time and is likely to continue to do so. In the 1990s, a decision was made by the global financial leadership to move significant resources, both money and business and manufacturing capacity, out of America to reinvest in the emerging markets with younger or larger populations, particularly in Asia. As a result, American consumers and businesses are experiencing growing competition for markets and resources from these emerging markets around the world. Second, we are experiencing a global centralization of economic and political power. This is re-engineering how our resources are managed and governed in fundamental ways. Resources and legal powers are being shifted out of the hands of communities and sovereign governments and centralized under the private control of large banks, corporations, and private investors. This includes a shifting of jurisdiction to international treaties like NAFTA and international governance structures like the International Monetary Fund, the IMF. These structures abrogate or negate U.S. laws and regulations. These changes are very likely to continue. Third, we are in the early stages of a shift from a bubble economy to a real economy. Market commentators will sometimes describe this as a shift from a bull market in financial assets to a bull market in commodities and tangible assets. Rather than encourage Americans to understand the challenges before us and meet them head on, a decision was made in the 1990s to create a bubble economy. I describe this decision in detail in my case study, Dylan Reed and the Aristocracy of Stock Profits. If you want to learn more about this process, you'll find a link for it on the resource page for this audio seminar. To finance the movement of trillions of capital out of the U.S. economy and into the emerging markets, we bubble the economy with very significant amounts of debt, including consumer debt, municipal and federal government debt, and mortgage debt. This included a significant amount of fraudulent debt and securities, which were sold both to investors in the U.S. and globally. Another way to describe this trend is we've literally pumped and dumped the American economy. The pump has been underway since the mid-1990s as part of the so-called strong dollar policy. This policy included two significant components, which I've written about and spoken about a great deal. First, trains missing from the U.S. Treasury, which has failed to comply with the laws requiring audited financial statements. And second, the suppression of the price of gold and silver and a transfer of government and central bank precious metal stores to private hands. Many of us have participated in this bubble economy, either investing directly or through our pension fund, mutual fund, or other investments. We have done this, for example, by maintaining our checking and savings account as a depositor with a bank engaged in predatory lending. We may have bought bank stocks inflated in value by profits from predatory lending and fraudulent mortgage securities. We may hold government bonds used to finance trillions leaving the government through the back door. When we invest in mutual funds and money market accounts that buy the mortgage-backed securities, we make predatory lending possible. In the process, we become disassociated from the real economy. Much of the bubble economy has been dependent on federal guarantees and federal credit, on government subsidies and purchases, and government and central bank intervention actively managing both the financial and commodities markets. Now the pump has run its course. The dump has begun. The housing bubble has popped, and now we're grappling with a real economy which has been crippled by a period of exploding debt levels and high consumption instead of investing in a shift to a sustainable economy. So, for example, we've been building lots of large homes that require lots of expensive fossil fuel to heat and lots of fossil fuel to commute to work from. A growing number of homeowners can no longer afford to heat them and pay the costs. Or they can't afford to pay the cost of gas to drive to work as their income is falling. It turns out their jobs, or many of their jobs, have been outsourced to Asia. Our local and state governments are often not in a position to help. They are managing significant budget challenges as tax revenues fall and their expenses rise. That includes pension contributions as state and local pension investment performance suffers. How do we pull our investments out of this bubble economy and shift them back into the real economy? Where are the opportunities to shift to a more sustainable economy, and how can we take advantage of them? The question for many of us is, how are we now going to start to make the transition that in hindsight we wish we had started to make in the 80s or 90s? For those who are on the road to transition, how can we reach out and help others do so in a financially sustainable manner? One of my favorite expressions is, a new world is percolating. The opportunity before us is to create many more ways to make this new world attractive to our own investment capital. While we seek to build those opportunities, it is critical that we make sure our investment capital is on solid ground in the real economy. How do we do so? Our goal at Solari is to help you make a way. Chapter 3, Solari Investment Strategy. There are 7 principles at the heart of Solari Investment Strategy. If you use them, they will help you navigate uncertain times and attract the people and organizations that can help you succeed in this environment. Principle number 1, use total economic return as a navigation tool, and only participate with players and activities that have a positive total economic return. The concept of total economic return is a tool for aligning our investments with what creates value for the wider communities and constituencies impacted. An investment has a return to the investor. It also has an impact on all the other players in the ecosystem in which the investment functions. At Solari, we call this impact, the return to the network. Just as the return to the investor can be positive or negative, so the return to the network can also be positive or negative. A combination of both return to the investor plus return to the network equals total economic return. Again, the total economic return can be positive or negative. Let me give you a real-world example. When my company, Hamilton Securities, was cleaning up defaulted mortgage portfolios for the federal government, we kept a tracking system to measure the benefits to our client of the transactions we were being paid to do. Our goal was that our client would receive many times the benefits of what we received from them as their investment banker. We also attempted to estimate and track the impact of the transactions on the communities and organizations impacted. Our goal was to make sure that communities were better off both financially and in terms of quality of life, and that the government was not doing something to save money on one hand that would create greater costs to the government and taxpayers on the other hand as an unintended consequence. By taking a wider ecosystem view than just how much money we were making on the specific transaction, we were able to identify and recommend ongoing improvements to the process, and these improvements generated greater savings both for the government and better results for homeowners and communities. Over time, the more people around us understood our efforts to understand the total economic returns of what we were doing and to align our returns with the returns of all the different ethical and lawful partners in a positive way, the greater the trust and speed of communication developed. As the benefits to the whole grew, our business grew rapidly. We also discovered that, in fact, many companies and organizations were making a great deal of money from the government to manage the failure of communities, and they were opposed to change that would result in communities succeeding. That is, we found out that many positive returns to investors were depending on a negative return to the network and negative total economic returns, and that was being financed by billions in government spending and borrowing. If a critical mass of participants had been willing to hold themselves to a standard of positive total economic return, tremendous improvement in quality of life and financial wealth was possible, and much of the pain that we are now experiencing might have been avoided. How to persuade them to do so? It became apparent that if each one of us, as a depositor, an investor, a consumer, a donor, would hold the organizations we transact with to these standards, a real shift was possible. That was when I realized how important it was to build a much wider understanding of the importance of citizens and investors withdrawing from and shunning any company or organization that has a negative return to the network. Solari Investment Strategy says, always try to understand the total economic return of the investments that you make or in which you participate, and use that information as a navigation tool to avoid risks and identify opportunities. Although we may see many opportunities to increase total economic return, we choose only those investments for ourselves from among them that have attractive investment returns for us. So we're using the traditional fiduciary construct of always looking to improve our own investment return. The change from the traditional approach is that we are striving for a much deeper understanding of the impact of our investment activities on the broader society as a way of identifying opportunities and integrating the knowledge gained in our investment decision-making. In addition, we are also adding a condition. We are saying that we will only achieve positive investment returns if we are confident that we can do it in a way that contributes to the whole. If we anticipate that an investment has a negative return to the network, we don't want to do it no matter what the investment returns to us. And we do not want to associate with players who will not operate by this standard. That is, we withdraw from and shun players wherever possible that have a negative return to the network. A term that we use as a rule of thumb for the total economic return within a place is the Popsicle Index. The Popsicle Index is a measure of the percent of people who believe a child can leave their home, go to the nearest place to buy a popsicle, and come home alone safely. So my rule of thumb, or quick way of saying total economic return in a community, is to talk about whether or not an investment makes the Popsicle Index go up or down. One of the natural results of using total economic return as a navigation tool is that we learn much more about the impact of different investments on places, including the natural environment. We also learn more about covert activities, including organized crime, and how it intersects with the investment community. A second result is that we decentralize our investment activities as much as possible. Currently, large banks and corporations and governments often depend on military and economic warfare and heavy government taxation, borrowing, and spending to achieve financial success. In short, they are not financially sustainable, and/or their returns to shareholders and investors are created or enhanced at the expense of citizens and all living things. Principle number two. Organize your portfolio in four quadrants: liquid versus non-liquid, and local versus global. We divide portfolios into four quadrants. First, we categorize investments according to what is liquid and what is not liquid. Liquid means that an investment is easily transacted. It's easy to find a price for it. It's easy to buy and sell without sacrificing value or paying high transaction costs. So if I invest in marketable gold coins, bonds, or stocks or certificates of deposit, I know I can convert back to cash quickly, albeit volatile prices could result in a loss or gain. If an investment is non-liquid, then it's not easy for a buyer and seller to arrive at a transaction price. There is no readily determined market price, or there's some impediment to free transferability. It's not easy for me to buy and sell. For example, if I invest in a venture fund where the interests are non-transferable, or I invest in a small business where there's no ready market for the loan or equity investment that I make, it's not possible for me to get my money quickly, either with no loss or even at all. In a bubble economy, we tend to invest in liquid securities and liquid investments. As we shift to investing in the real economy, we will gradually see more opportunities in the non-liquid area, particularly for those of us who are interested in going local or building more self-sufficiency in our own lives or in our communities. One of the many reasons that we take steps to live simply and reduce our overhead is that the lower our day-to-day cash expenses, the lower the amount of our assets we need to keep in liquid form. In addition to dividing our portfolio between liquid and non-liquid, we also look at whether an investment is local or global. In a bubble economy, many investors invest in large banks and corporations whose operations are multinational. At Solari, what we think of as this investing globally is something more intimate. We're interested in investing directly in enterprises or assets in places globally, using our network and using our own understanding of different places and different kinds of investments to invest in areas or operations in other places. So when you use the Solari construct, local is my home base, where I am, my neighborhood, my place. Global is lots of other distinct places all around the world, full of real people, real resources, and excellent enterprises and products and services that we can learn about and connect with through networks of trust. That means we don't have to depend on large multinational intermediaries whose control within local places often comes as a result of their centralized command of our capital. Principle number three, help address your concerns about the future with scenario planning. Solari investment strategy depends on scenario planning. We can't predict the future. We can, however, understand what risks and challenges may present themselves in the future. Freedom comes from anticipating what could happen in the worst case and having a plan to deal with it. Along with planning for all the traditional risks of sickness, aging, accidents, litigation, and death, those risks that we typically use insurance and savings to address, planning for the worst case scenarios in the larger environment is at the heart of good risk management. We attempt to allocate time and money in a manner that helps us stay on solid ground in all possible future scenarios. That way, we can focus our time and attention on creating the best possible future for our world and ourselves. This type of planning is important to leaving a framework in which we are dependent on experts and centralized systems. We're leaving a framework of being a responder to the bubble and moving to be a player in the real economy that's trying to build the kind of future that we want. Principle number four, diversification. Diversify, diversify, diversify. Diversify your knowledge. Diversify the places in which you invest. Diversify the assets in which you invest. Every investment has risk. Every place has risk. I can come up with a scenario to destroy the value of any investment, no matter how conservative. I dare say the people in New Orleans understand the kind of risk you can have in a place. Or the family who, after selling their company on the New Jersey ports, gave several hundred million of the proceeds to an investment bank to invest in, quote, risk-free investments. They soon lost it all. You can read that story in my blog post, which is linked from the resource page. It's a chilling example. We are living in an increasingly volatile world. Diversification says, don't put all my eggs in one basket. I have different kinds of investments that deal with different kinds of uncertainties and different kinds of risks. I have different kinds of assets in different kinds of places. I have different kinds of custodians and servicers. Use diversification to significantly increase your staying power, come what may. Now, for every rule, there are some exceptions, in part driven by how much in assets a person has and what your particular lifestyle and dream is. For example, there are some portfolios which could have a significant percentage in precious metals, especially in portfolios that are transitioning from a bubble economy to a real economy. Precious metals can serve as a safe haven while, for example, we move to greater local or greater non-liquid investments, which can take time to prudently due diligence and structure. I would note that it is important to diversify those precious metals by where they are held and the form in which they are held, and make sure you're prepared to manage the price volatility. Other portfolios could have a significant amount in their local category relative to global. Again, every person, family, and situation is unique. Principle number five, practice financial intimacy. Financial intimacy says, where my money goes and what it does in my name, there am I. What that means is we're integrating our lives with our financial transactions and partners. My money adds value to my life and those around me. It is a tool that I use to build my world and contribute to the building of my community. So if the world is changing and I'm changing with it, note what products and services are the most valuable for my family and me. See if the companies and organizations providing those services to you might be good investments. Look for opportunities to stop being intermediated by strangers. So for example, why keep money in financial assets of large institutions that you do not know and trust, just so you can earn income that you then use to buy food and water from other companies you don't trust? Sell the financial assets and use the money to dig a well or invest in farmland on which a local farmer who you do trust can grow food that is of the highest quality. With financial intimacy, our values, our goals, and our life are integrated with the values and goals that we expect of those whom we entrust with our money. We do this in part for moral reasons. We're responsible for the kind of future that we finance and build. As we inherited the blessings of the generations before us, we also have an obligation to pass on those blessings to the next generation. In addition, when we do business or finance people who have a record of being untrustworthy and harming other people, places, and investors, we put our own money, even our own lives, at risk. Non-sustainable activities ultimately result in losses. It's like a game of musical chairs, like the ones that resulted in the losses on the dot-com bubble, the telecom stocks, or recently reports of fraudulently packaged mortgage securities. I have personally seen many too many situations where banks, auditors, insurance companies, other professionals have used their inside position with a customer to systematically harm that customer to aid their own company or a third party. Imagine your insurance company, your accountant, your business consultant, your lawyer, your bank, giving your private data to your competitor, threatening you or helping third parties steal from you or falsely frame you. Imagine your broker recommending securities to get them out of their firm's inventory. In a world of economic warfare, these things really do happen, and we want to make sure that they don't happen to us. When we practice financial intimacy, we do business with or invest in the people we know and trust, or the people and the things that the people we know and trust. We follow a chain of trust to help us manage the complexity and changes with which we're dealing. We get bad actors or potentially bad actors out of our lives. We have stopped depending on people we don't know and entrusting our time and assets to any enterprises that do not hold an honorable intention for our families and for us. Remember, we are not obligated to be fair in our market choices. In a court of law, someone is innocent until proven guilty. In today's financial marketplace, it is wise to assume that someone is not ethical or competent until we proactively have reason to believe that they are. And even then, we must understand that they are doing their best, which in an uncertain world is not always going to be right. Ultimately, we must all be our own best counselors and take responsibility for ourselves and our assets. Principle number 6, organize. Don't worry if people say there is a conspiracy. If you're not in one, you need to start one. The way that things get done in this world, particularly in the financial and investment area, is that people organize to act together, to act in concert. That's really what a conspiracy is. The world is run by conspiracies, thousands, if not millions of them. I would not worry about all of them. Rather, again, if you're not in one or not in one that is working for you, then you need to start one. We are managing globalization and economic change. We're managing in a much more volatile situation. We're living with greater uncertainty. There are more wild cards, particularly as technology grows and the speed of information increases. What this means is we need to find ways to deal with greater complexity, including in more places and more industries. One of the best ways to do that is to organize. A Solari Circle is a financial action club of 12 people or fewer, people you absolutely know and trust. You can form a Solari Circle to create a positive intention, to educate yourself, to take actions, as well as to invest together. There is wide latitude for your circle to do only those things which best serve its members. What is critical is that you organize to build skills and allies in the art of financial action. Principle number 7, Plain Net Energy Plus. Effective financial collaboration and action improves as we adopt protocols that are what I call Net Energy Plus. In a sense, this is applying the principle of total economic return to your investment of time and attention throughout your daily life. Think of the video you watch at the beginning of every plane flight that says, "Put your own oxygen mask on first." Sustainability includes financial sustainability. Ditto for those around you. That means we need much richer communication about financial collaboration. As our short-term changes or actions free up energy, we get more energy for more changes. If you have not read our Coming Clean piece, I also encourage you to do so. It is linked from the resource page. Put your oxygen mask on first, and as you do, turn to give energy to another in a way that gives you energy. Chapter 4, Opportunities. There are 7 areas of opportunity that are at the heart of Solari investment strategy. One of the nice things about being at the beginning of a fundamental shift, such as the one that we're in, is that all of these opportunities are likely to last for quite some time. We can start learning about them now, confident that our investment of time has plenty of time to bear fruit. It's not too late to get going, and there is plenty of room for lots more investors. Opportunity number 1, personal self-sufficiency. Traditionally, many Americans invest in financial assets, earn a return, and use that return to provide for our day-to-day living needs. As centralized systems become less reliable and more expensive, we are going to see more and more opportunities to invest directly to provide for our own daily needs or to do so in cooperation with our neighbors. Why leave money in risky financial investments when shifting the money over to retire debt or install alternative energy, build a well, provide for a local food supply, will permanently reduce our income needs despite rising expenses of energy, water, and food. Monetary authorities, both the Federal Reserve and central banks around the world, are increasing money supply to protect large banks and other insiders in dramatic amounts. As the housing and other debt bubbles wind down, one way to address both debt and related derivative problems is to continually inflate the money supply. As this happens, our expenses start to rise. Our food expenses go up, our gas expenses go up. What will compound the problem is that we are now going to increasingly compete for these resources with the many emerging economies around the world. What can you do to simplify and increase the self-sufficiency of your home base? What can you do to lower your expenses and reduce your operational dependency on centralized systems? I know a lot of people say to me, "Well, it's not economic to be my own gardener. It's not economic yet to do alternative energy." It's important when we look at the economics of taking the time or investing the money to increase our self-sufficiency to think in terms of how prices will continue to accelerate. It takes time to implement these solutions. There is still a limited capacity of people and companies to help you implement these solutions. So whether it's starting an urban or community garden with your neighbors, or downsizing your apartment or house, or implementing alternative energies, or lowering the amount of energy consumption you use, start to take continuous actions to improve your personal self-sufficiency. Protect yourself from rising expenses and the potential of deterioration in either the reliability or availability of essential services and resources. Start now. If it would be energizing for you, start a Solari Circle to help you educate yourself and share the journey with people that you know and trust. One of the things I regularly recommend is to stockpile essential goods. Carrying much larger inventories of non-perishable items typically has a better return on your investment than keeping your money in a bank in U.S. dollar denominated form. This is an environment where it pays to either reduce your debt as much as possible or to use debt very judiciously, because even though we may be inflating currently, a deflationary spiral is still possible. And for many people, even if we remain generally in an inflation mode, incomes are dropping. Again, the lower the monthly expenses and overhead we can have, the less our risk. Finally, we are in a physical environment that is increasingly toxic and stressful. Hence, one of the best investments we can make is in taking excellent care of ourselves and taking the time to maintain and improve our physical health and strength. It is not an optimal investment to keep significant funds in financial assets while underinvesting in excellent health. Indeed, one of the common causes of financial stress is health problems. This is another reason why it is so important to ensure that we have secure sources of very high quality food and water. Opportunity number two, family, community, and network self-sufficiency. One of the first things we discover when we start to increase our personal self-sufficiency is that individual self-sufficiency is difficult, if not impossible, to attain. Evolving towards a more self-sufficient lifestyle is a lot more energizing when we do so in cahoots with those members of our family, community, and network who are interested in evolving with us. The more you encourage those around you to explore and share those actions, which are mutually energizing, the more options open up for you. If you have the resources to do so, it makes sense to not be dependent solely on your home base. Let's say I choose to live in a particular place and invest to become more self-sufficient in that place. Again, who knows what could happen to that place? Why not have a modest second home in another place, co-located with family or people you know? That place could also be a good financial investment. Be careful, many places right now are not. It could be in a community that offers the opportunity for sound local investment. I often tell this story about litigating against parties who tried hard to cut me off from all my resources. I had either given or lent family and friends $250,000. They made an effort to repay it. Some members of my family made loans or gifts. That was the one source of money that couldn't be shut off to me, and it kept me alive during that period. What I discovered is that when you bank good, hardworking people, they will bank you. So think of local investment as a way of investing in the critical resources that you need. Food, water, energy, quality resources you need to make sure you're self-sufficient, but will also help your neighbors, family, and others be self-sufficient. As you start to explore local investment, focus on those goods and services that are essential to you and your family. How can you use your investment to reduce your costs and provide you with sustainable access to critical resources? Opportunity number three, bank intimately. In a financially intimate world, one of our most important relationships is with our banker. I'm always stunned when people tell me, well, I don't have much money, and so it's not important where I bank. We've put up on the resource page a short article by Franklin Sanders of The Money Changer called How Big is the Reserve? His calculations in 2006 show $1 of bank deposit in the system was ultimately multiplied out throughout the banking system to $164 in loans. Most Americans are banking at large banks. We are putting our deposits in the bank, and that bank is leveraging that money and loaning it out. Our money gives the large banking system resources to centralize the economy and engage in the practices we say we object to. If we withdraw our deposits out of these banks and shift back to well-managed local banks and credit unions that are circulating more locally, we can have a potentially dramatic impact on creating greater liquidity in local economies and in the real economy. As the bubble economy slows down, a credit crunch is unfolding. That means we send our deposits into centralized financial centers, and that money doesn't come back. Instead, the centralized players are shutting small business owners off from credit. It's exactly what we watched in 1988 and 1989 when I was the Assistant Secretary of Housing in the first Bush administration. As the bubble burst, problems were kept quiet during the presidential campaign during 1988. After the inauguration, credit really tightened and was shut off to scores of small businesses across the country, while our deposits and investments protected the largest banks and companies and insiders. In 1993, in an attempt to obtain a small business loan for my business, I had lunch with the head of corporate lending in the D.C. area for a large multinational bank. He explained that his bank had no plans to make small business loans of any meaningful volume in the District of Columbia. I had checked the bank's latest filings with the Securities and Exchange Commission that morning. According to their annual report, they had approximately $110 billion invested in treasury bonds on their balance sheet. Essentially, the American taxpayers were providing this bank with the mechanism to borrow short-term at a low price using the credit of the American people through federal deposit insurance, and then use those funds together with our deposits to lend those very same funds to our government long-term at a 550 basis point spread, or 5.5% greater. The bank had a resource guarantee of our taxpayer credit by investing in U.S. Treasury securities guaranteed with the full faith and credit of the U.S. government, and refused to lend to my small business because it was not good enough business for the bank. I estimated that this particular bank that year would reap $6 billion in low-risk profit by inserting itself as an unnecessary intermediary between our savings as depositors and our government's borrowings on behalf of us as taxpayers and citizens. Our financial system is like the body in trauma, and instead of shifting the blood to the heart and lungs, we're sending the blood to the toes. And as we do it, we're being drained. First and foremost, the currency that we are placing our funds in is declining in value. Second, our money is being used to finance activities that are also draining our communities or other communities around the world and giving power to the wrong sort of people. It's not someone else making the decision, it's us. What we want to do is to start creating liquidity in our local places and between local places without going through these big intermediaries. Disintermediation starts with shifting our resources to banks run by local financial leaders whom we know and we can trust and who have a positive intention for our families and us and are trying to do more locally. It continues to the extent possible by doing the same with our other financial relationships, our accountant, our brokerage company, or any of the relationships in the companies that we use to finance and transact with. As we start to bring this kind of intimacy and take the time and responsibility to make sure who is managing our transactions and our financial data, we start to build liquidity in the real economy and not let it get siphoned off to the bubble economy. Opportunity number four, use silver and gold as real money. One thing that 6 billion people globally agree on is that silver and gold are money. Existing stores of precious metals serve as a currency that is not dependent on government control or management, and is not dependent on warfare and coercion to prop up its value. That makes gold and silver useful commodities during periods when government and numerous powerful people are behaving in an unpredictable, untrustworthy, or lawless manner. Since the mid-1990s, the central banks and government treasuries have been privatizing precious metal stores. In the process, we are seeing government intervention in the markets to suppress prices. This has the effect of turning off the financial smoke and burglar alarms. This makes it easier to subsidize the dollar to ensure that its fall is managed. As a result, there is a buying opportunity in precious metals during this period of suppression. I started recommending precious metals when gold was valued at $350 per ounce. Now that it is over $900, I am often told, "Oh well, it is too late to buy. I have missed it." It is not too late to buy. The probabilities are high that we are at the beginning of a long-term bull market for precious metals, as gold and silver increasingly become one currency of choice globally. As a result, the precious metals market is a useful safe haven. It's highly liquid, which means it's a way of getting our assets on solid ground in the real economy quickly. It is also highly volatile against the dollar, and I expect that to continue. So it is essential to not switch funds into precious metals that are needed in the short term. Investing funds that you need within the next 6 to 12 months in precious metals can lead to significant losses. In addition, if the centralized monopoly of gold and silver continues, a day may come when the price can be entirely controlled politically. We are not there yet, but this is something to watch for. Of course, on that day, we will only have the option of investing where we are told, if we have the option at all. Even if that scenario were to emerge, precious metals may continue to hold value in an underground economy. Avoiding that situation is another reason to decentralize ownership and control of outstanding inventories of gold and silver. We have a terrific introductory audio seminar series about investing in precious metals. I strongly recommend that if you have not listened to it, that you do so and stay updated as we do additional ones in the future. Opportunity number 5, natural resources. Investing in the real economy is all about back to basics. So natural resources are going to be an important area of opportunity. Our planet has a population of 6 billion people and growing. Emerging markets are increasing demand for resources globally. That means competition for limited natural resources. The most important natural resources are food and water. However, the list of opportunities is long, including base metals, energy, and land. In a bubble economy, place tended not to matter, with place-based risks replaced by government and financial institution guarantees. As the real economy grows in importance and the U.S. economy declines, the economic health of places is going to grow in importance. For some time now, if you visit the top performer mutual fund section at Yahoo Finance, you will see the top performing categories are often place-based. For example, funds that target China or India or Latin America. I expect this trend to continue, with the targeted places eventually growing smaller than a continent or a country. Investing in natural resources with Solari investment strategy means looking for opportunities to diversify ownership and control of natural resources. A second aspect will be finding opportunities to finance leaders in making natural resource use and development more sustainable and more aligned with the best interests of the impacted communities. That is, helping us convert our use of natural resources to a more sustainable model. Opportunity number 6, countries with a high popsicle index. There is a reference list on the resource page for this audio seminar of the characteristics of countries with a high popsicle index. Again, the popsicle index is the percentage of people who believe a child can leave their home, go to the nearest place to buy a popsicle, and come home alone safely. So if the popsicle index is 100%, it means 100% of the people in that place believe a child can leave their home, go to the nearest place to buy a popsicle, and come home alone safely. These are countries that tend to be rich in natural resources and low in debt relative to their population. They invest in education and have a high learning metabolism. They invest in their people. Their cultures have much greater alignment between living equity and financial equity. Additional characteristics are listed in the outline on the resource page. These countries and enterprises in them represent an investment opportunity. Their currencies are usually stronger than our currency, and their sovereign government bonds are typically grounded in the fundamental economics of place. That is, they are not counting on the ability of the government to force their will internally or around the world. So in the long run, they're much more sustainable as a fixed income investment. When you look for successful natural resource or other enterprises or assets, keep these countries and markets in mind. Opportunity number 7, enterprises that have positive total economic and investor returns. Finally, of course, we have enterprises, which invest and manage all these things we have been discussing. We're moving from a non-sustainable economy to a sustainable economy. So where are the enterprises that are great at providing basic essential services and will evolve those services in a continuously more sustainable way while providing good returns as they do it? Where are the enterprises that are excellent at getting the most for the least with respect to our precious natural resources, restoring the environment, or implementing new technology that really helps us get from a very wasteful economy to a zero-waste economy? Where are the enterprises that do not depend on warfare, organized crime, and dirty tricks for their financial soundness and survival? This area will be one of the great opportunities, if not the greatest, over the next 2 decades. One of the issues that will arise in this area is both the growth as well as the transformation of what is called socially responsible investment, or SRI. Many publicly traded SRI mutual funds have contributed to centralizing the economy. Ethical people believe they're getting a positive total economic return on their funds when in fact they are instead buying a vehicle that is whitewashing or greenwashing dirty players. If you're interested in learning more, listen to our Solari audio seminar, Beyond Socially Responsible Investing, Part 1, Is SRI Hazardous to Our Wealth? While cash management is not an opportunity per se, rather an ongoing necessity, I'd like to say a few words about liquidity options. When we are managing our finances in a currency that is rising in value, short-term cash management is relatively simple. We put money in a bank or a money market fund, and it holds its value. However, when we are managing our finances in a currency that is falling in value, and banks and money markets may be holding financial assets that may have been fraudulently or incompetently created, or are financing activities that we do not want to finance, things get more complicated. As a result, we are well served to diversify to other currencies, all of which take time to learn, and even when we have mastered them, involve greater volatility in the short run. So cash management becomes a much more complicated subject and is another reason I like to encourage lower expenses and overhead and greater personal inventories of tangible goods. So that's our review of 7 areas of opportunity. For those of you who've been used to putting your money in a bubble economy and not thinking about it, it's a lot to learn. I would encourage you to take your time to review the outline and the materials on the resource page. I want to stress again, everybody is different. Every person and every individual financial situation are unique. So scan these opportunities with an eye to learning about those which are appropriate for your situation. That is going to be different for each person. I also want to stress that all investments have risk. There is no such thing as a sure thing. Successful investing is a continuous journey with losses and gains. Managing risks and losses are inevitable, and learning from them is part of a successful investment strategy. Chapter 5, Scenarios. Just as we had 7 principles at the heart of Solari investment strategy, and we had 7 opportunities, there are 7 scenarios that we use to plan and manage the political and economic risks in our wider environment. We have listed them at the resource page under the outline. As you are listening, I encourage you to review the chart in the outline that lists the scenarios and connects the seven opportunities to the seven scenarios. One of the reasons we use these scenarios is because many members in our network have expressed concern about them. Our goal is to help you use your resources not to predict which scenario of the future will come true, but rather to improve your odds of being fine in all possible scenarios. In an investment portfolio, some investments do well in some scenarios and some do well in others. That kind of balance is a built-in protection against uncertainty. One of the drivers of resource allocation to the various sectors of opportunities is the probability that one assigns to the likelihood of each scenario. Scenario number one, peak oil. The first scenario we've listed is peak oil. Peak oil is a scenario that says we will need to deindustrialize the first world as the global stores of fossil fuels diminish. Proponents of peak oil believe that this process of deindustrialization could in fact be very rapid. One of my favorite Tina Turner sayings is, "We can do this nice or rough." What you'll hear from the peak oil folks is that deindustrialization process could in fact be quite rough. The first opportunity we discussed was personal self-sufficiency. The second opportunity we discussed was family and community self-sufficiency. Both these opportunities are responsive to the peak oil scenario. If peak oil is a possible future outcome, we want to make sure we're not dependent on centralized systems and we reduce our dependence on energy and on food items obtained from sources that may expose us to skyrocketing costs or shortages. Banking intimately is also important because it's not enough that we're self-sufficient in terms of food or energy. We need to be self-sufficient in terms of being able to create and maintain financial liquidity in our place. I'll often see people focus on the asset side of life, which again is real things, food, water, shelter, and not realize that if we leave all of our capital and retirement savings invested in the bubble economy, as opposed to finding ways of moving it over and investing it in our local area and the self-sufficiency we're trying to build, then we're sabotaging ourselves. Our support of highly centralized financial institutions may mean that as challenging times come, we will be financing strangers and making it possible for them to come up and buy up our resources. Again, a new world is percolating, and one of the key issues is, can we make it bankable so that we can withdraw our resources from activities and people we do not wish to support and reinvest them wisely in developing the newly self-sufficient world that we want to create? I was at a great investment conference in New Orleans about a year and a half ago, and someone asked the famous investor, Jimmy Rogers, if he was concerned about peak oil, and he looked at them with a very droll smile and said, "Forget peak oil, it's peak everything." Scenario number two is peak everything. The peak everything scenario is the scenario that says we're going to experience intense competition globally for all natural resources, not just oil. It's water. It's food. It's land. Not surprisingly, the response is very similar as the response for peak oil. The key question this scenario raises is, how can we build greater self-sufficiency and how can we do it in a way where we start to generate a higher quality of life with fewer resources? So how can we re-engineer our manufacturing? How can we re-engineer our consumption? How can we re-engineer all the different processes of daily life so that we use fewer natural resources for any given thing that we're trying to achieve or do? How do we do so in a manner that improves the quality of our health, our families, our culture, and our community? Scenarios three and four, deflation and inflation. Deflation is simply a decrease in the money supply. A lot of times people will talk about deflation also as a decrease in prices. For example, collapsing asset values such as the decreases we are experiencing in the prices of homes. However, its strict definition is not that. It is a decrease in the supply of money. Deflation gets tricky to talk about because we often see inflation and deflation happening at the same time in different sectors. Let me explain. Inflation is an increase in the money supply. As I said earlier, we're watching the central banking authorities increase money supply dramatically as they bail out large banks and investment banks with subprime mortgages or leverage buyout or derivative market losses. While this increases money supply, the banks are not loaning as much money as before, so the multiplier of bank reserves and deposits in the system is shrinking. There is more money for Wall Street, but less money for Main Street. So if you're on Main Street, that may mean rising expenses, inflation, but shrinking credit and income, deflation. As the process continues, faith on Main Street in the system deteriorates. That triggers a decrease in spending, a decrease in the circulation of money generally, and more hoarding, hence more deflation. In a deflationary future, we want to protect ourselves by investing in, for example, AAA sovereign bonds of high popsicle index countries with strong currencies. These are assets which hold their nominal value even in a worst-case deflationary scenario. So when assets drop in value, we benefit from owning an asset issued by an entity that is likely to still have resources to pay the nominal value they committed to pay. In inflation, we want to protect ourselves by owning things that will increase in value and not be limited to a given nominal value. I heard someone say recently that in an inflation, you wanted to own long-term bonds for the same time that you would hold a grenade with its pin pulled. Rather, in inflation, real things tend to hold their intrinsic purchasing power. This would include commodities, natural resources, and other tangibles. You'll hear financial people say, we're going through a shift from a bull market in financial assets to a bull market in tangibles. This is in part reflecting the deterioration in the quality of financial assets and currencies. We are recording this audio seminar in June 2008. We are watching numerous indicators that signal increased risks of both inflation and deflation. 20 years ago, we had a bursting housing and real estate bubble and credit crunch coming into a presidential election. Wall Street and Washington kept a lid on the losses until the election was over. After the inauguration, we saw the credit crunch grow considerably, slamming many asset values. During this period, I transitioned from watching the problems unfold on Wall Street to serving as a government official addressing the financial ramifications in 1989 and 1990. My concern today is that we run significant risks of inflating expenses while many people's income and asset values suffer as the credit crunch spreads and deepens. Key events to watch over the next year include a new federal budget negotiated after Labor Day, with the market responding to those decisions in October, and the presidential and congressional elections in November. Then comes the inauguration in January, and disclosure and tax dates for corporations in March, and taxes due for individuals in April. Our economic fundamentals are significantly more fragile than they were in 1988. That means that the adjustment this fall and next year could be more painful. The risks of serious inflation or deflation are real. This is a period that calls for caution. We have posted several pieces on the resource page by Franklin Sanders that will help you understand the signs of both inflation and deflation. Scenario number 5, slow burn. Slow burn is a scenario I named that describes a politically managed, centralized market economy in which government policies and inflation protect insider revenues and asset values at the expenses of outsiders, The outsiders experience deflating revenues and asset values while their expenses inflate. Let me give you an example. Many, many people in America are experiencing a drop in income and drop in housing prices. Wall Street holders of securities backed by mortgages that are losing value as a result of this same drop in housing prices can take their mortgage-backed securities and use them as collateral at the Federal Reserve to borrow. They can then take the proceeds of those borrowings and invest them in federal credit arbitrages, as I described before, for example, investing them in long treasury bonds at a profit and generate automatic profits with little or no risk. So the insider is protected from the drop in asset values and can generate income to offset them, whereas the outsider is not protected. A slow burn economy is defined by economic warfare between insiders and outsiders. Economic managers use a combination of overt and covert central bank and government policies to centralize control and ownership in the hands of the insiders. As a result, the financial assets of insiders are protected by draining the equity of communities and of families. This is happening in a way that has devastating consequences for the environment and living things. In a slow burn, we want to become continuously more self-sufficient. We also want to bank intimately. In addition, we want to use a balanced combination of the strategies we would use in both an inflation and a deflation. Scenario number 6, meltdown and collapse. Another scenario we hear a lot about is the Armageddon scenario. There are several versions of this. One is a U.S. economic hit. Throughout the 90s, we watched economic hits on different places. Russia in the 1990s was a well-documented example, as was Latin America. I believe the Asian financial crisis in 1997 was also an example. Significant funds are drawn out of the economy through either legal or extra-legal means, and credit is cut off or reduced, causing a collapse in the economy in short order. Predatory lenders can then buy up resources cheaply, including with the funds they just withdrew to bring on the collapse. One version of the Armageddon scenario says that the U.S. experiences an economic hit similar to Russia or Latin America. Another is that the global financial system goes into a meltdown as the ravages of economic warfare by and between various cartels are too much for the system to bear. Another variation describes a depression globally and a collapse of industrial economies. In some variations, these are exacerbated or dominated by changes in global weather patterns and natural calamities, or what some refer to as earth changes. I think the chances of a global collapse or meltdown happening are small. However, because the possible implications are so extreme for all of us, I encourage you to learn about them and to prepare. We've put links to a series of different resources up on the resource page, including two blog posts on disaster preparedness that link to excellent articles and books by people who've lived through this type of experience. What you will discover when you attempt to plan through these types of scenarios is that the steps we take to prepare against the various Armageddon scenarios are actually quite sensible investments of time and resources in a slow burn and some of the other scenarios as well. Increasing personal self-sufficiency is a sound investment for many people in all these scenarios, particularly given the price increases that we're experiencing now and expect in the future, and the increasing risks related to quality and reliability of existing systems. Scenario number 7, transformation. The scenario I'm most focused on personally is what I call transformation. It is invaluable to prepare for risks. At the same time, we did not come into this world to live in fear. We came here to love, to serve a purpose, to enjoy life and each other. After assessing and preparing sensibly for risks, let's focus our time and resources on the unique contribution that we each want to make. we're going through a dramatic shift for the first world to go from an unsustainable economy to one in which we are both sustainable and integrated with societies all over the world will be very dramatic. There are a lot of very exciting things going on. So where do you and I want to be in this? What's our contribution to help make this transformation nice, not rough? Where can we have the greatest impact? Ultimately, we want to organize our investments of time, money, and other resources as players according to where we want to play and contribute to the creation of real living and financial wealth in the real economy. In short, we ask ourselves, where can we personally have the greatest impact on improving total economic return that has a positive return for us? Within that umbrella, what are our personal goals? Where do we want to live? At what age do we want to retire? Do we want to have a family or not? What and how do we want to provide for our family and our children? What are the practical risks that we all must manage? Car accidents, disability, divorce, street crime, aging. These are things that we don't want to let sink us. A transforming plan will do better if it has withstood the kind of stress tests that good insurance agents and financial planners can put us through just in case a global financial meltdown does not relieve us from those risks which are common in all of our lives. The more specifically we can draw a picture of where we want to go, the easier it is to get there. In addition to these seven scenarios, there are a few wild cards I would like to touch on briefly. First, we have both new technology developing rapidly, as well as the possibility that suppressed technology could become more widely available. Second, new technology also means extraordinary developments in the technology of warfare, control, and manipulation, much of which is still secret. Finally, we're experiencing a variety of weather and geological or earth changes which can have a devastating impact on any given place. Although opinions vary, these changes may be responsive to our behavior as well as the use of invisible weaponry. These wild cards may radically change the future, including in positive ways, to the extent that the human race can evolve to a much higher level of spiritual, emotional, and cultural maturity. Hence, ultimately, the one thing we all know we can do to encourage this evolution is by evolving ourselves. Again, I encourage you to use our Coming Clean piece linked on the resource page for this audio